Thanks, Barry. Hopefully, the microphone is working. Thanks to the organizers for the invitation. It's slightly intimidating to have a piano sitting up on the stage here. I'm not going to be playing that. That's for your benefit, not mine. So I'm going to be talking about EDMs, but since this is, a partially introductory talk, I've got two parts to it. And depending on how the time goes and how lenient the chair is going to be, I also want to try and draw a few connections between EDMs and some of the other themes for this meeting, which is, of course, about atomic and nuclear physics, precision tests, and other aspects that go beyond, say, tests of T-violation, neutrino mass, dark matter, and so on. So the first part of the talk will be specifically a very brief overview of some aspects of EDMs and precision tests. There'll be a number of other talks during the week, and I'll try to make a note of those as we go through. And so I'll leave some things for later in the week so you don't see them multiple times. And then the second part of the talk will be about some comments on implications for new physics. And I'll split this into two parts, one that's mainly historical, just to have a look at what's happened over an extended period of time, particularly in regard to atomic and nuclear aspects of EDMs and new physics. And then I'll talk about some newer work on constraints on light hidden sectors, which tie into aspects of neutrino mass and dark matter. Okay, so just a quick run through, again, many experts in the room, so I'll be fairly brief on this, but EDMs are interesting because we think there's good motivation for new sources of CT violation in nature. So this comes from baryogenesis. It's in some ways kind of generic in quantum field theory, although it's not generic in the standard model for special reasons. And we already have puzzles related to, in particular, the theta parameter in QCD as to why it's so small. So this sort of general motivations. And EDMs at the non-relativistic level just imply this what might be called linear Stark effects, so a linear shift due to the applied electric field. And there's been a huge amount of work over many years, going back over 60 years now to the work of Purcell and Ramsey, on trying to measure intrinsic EDMs of different particles in a range of different settings. And it's useful, or has been useful, to sort of classify them into three groups. Paramagnetic systems, which are dealing with atoms and molecules, and you're looking mainly at the sort of unpaired electron, or the effects of that unpaired electron in the system. Diamagnetic EDMs, which don't have the unpaired electron, and so you're looking mainly at nuclear effects, and that's going to be a topic, sort of focus topic for this talk. And then a lot of work, perhaps the longest history, is around measuring the EDM of the neutron. And there are a number of groups working on this. The best limits at the moment in this case come from the ACME experiment at Harvard. John Doyle will talk about that. In the diamagnetic case, a long-running experiment at the University of Washington, which has by far the strongest limit now in that category, and Blaine Eckel will talk about that one. And in the neutron case, the existing limit is a little bit older, but there is a lot of work around the world on trying to improve that. So these are the current limits represented in sort of conventional units, E centimeters in those categories, and a large list of talks during this week on the experimental results and proposals for future experiments. So the first part of the talk is going to be, again, sort of introductory, and again, for many of you, I think this is all very familiar, but I want to go through it primarily to set some notation and then make some comments that hopefully will be useful for discussion during the week. So this is, like any precision measurement, there's a whole technology associated with effective field theory to try and interpret what's going on. You have some underlying source, in this case a source of CP violation, but then when you measure the effects, your sort of view is hidden through various layers, and so the observable EDMs may be at the nuclear level, or they may be at the atomic or molecular level, and so theoretically you need to trace back through some hierarchy. Usually it's a distance scale hierarchy to try and understand what's going on. So conventionally and perhaps conveniently, this has been sort of QCD scale, nuclear and atomic scale, and then getting to the observable EDMs. Traditionally, again, the assumption has been that any new source of CP violation is short distance, and so this hierarchy is sort of vertical, but One of the themes for this talk anyway is that given what we know now about high energy physics and particular input from the LHC, I think these questions have become broadened a little bit, and it's possible that new sources of CP violation motivated in the way that I mentioned before could come in at different scales, and so have to imagine that this could feed into this effective field theory network at different levels. And I'll give you an example of that right at the end of the talk. Okay, so this is just making that picture a little bit more precise. We can write down basis of operators at around 1 GeV, some QCD scale operators. That's not necessarily the right or the most convenient description at the nuclear level, so you have to translate that into basis of operators at the nuclear level. There's been a lot of work on doing that systematically in the last few years. And then try to compute all of the observable effects, which may be at the atomic or possibly molecular scale. So at the QCD scale, it's not difficult to write down a basis of CPOD operators ordered in terms of increasing dimension. There's only one at dimension 4, that's the theta term. There are electric dipole moment operators of the quarks and the leptons. There are basically this is a chromoelectric dipole moment of the quarks. There's a chromoelectric dipole moment of the gluon Weinberg operator. Special class of four Fermi operators that are dimension 6, and then, of course, you keep going. And in many cases, the assumption would be that these effects would be larger than these ones, and those would be larger than these ones, and so on. It's not necessarily true, of course, because it depends on the theory. In the standard model, as I'll come to later, it turns out that these guys are probably the most important, just because these ones are not generated at the same level for symmetry reasons. Of course, this one could be important, but doesn't seem to be for reasons that are not so well understood. And I think Vincenzo will talk more about some of this later on. Okay, so that's the first level. And then the first important job is to try and calculate from there what the transition is to the nuclear scale. And again, there's been a lot of work systematizing the set of relevant operators that you should consider at the nuclear scale. So these include EDMs of the nucleons, two CPOD pion nucleon couplings, there are four nucleon contact interactions, there's a three pion vertex, and then at the leptonic sector, there's the EDM of the electron, and these semi-leptonic operators, which are also quite significant, coupling the electron to nucleons. And I know that Jordi De Vries is giving a talk later in the week, and I'm sure he'll cover this in more detail than I'll do here. I think one of the advantages of all the work recently is to understand exactly what the chiral counting parameters are here, so you can understand why these operators should be dominant, assuming chiral counting is going to work for the new physics that we're looking at. And it emphasized probably the importance of these two, or potential importance of these two operators that hadn't been studied as much in the past. Although, actually, this operator, which I haven't written down in full, these are just for simplicity. This three pion operator was actually discussed in the very first paper by the group of Schiffman, Weinstein, Zakharov, that looked at the importance of CP violation for the strong interactions and actually mentioned that things like eta to pi plus pi minus could be a way to see this effect. So that's exactly that operator. But it doesn't seem to be the most important one in the list for the moment. Okay, so that's this level. You keep going down, you would eventually end up with these contributions, and that's a calculational problem in atomic and nuclear physics. And in many cases, that's either relatively straightforward, or at least the technology is known. In other cases, it's a problem, and I'll come back to it later on. So this is just to emphasize in one way, why EDMs are so useful as precision probes, and perhaps in another way, as a sort of a lesson to think very carefully about what the leading contributions might be. These are the contributions coming from the CKM phase in the standard model, and they're not actually that easy to compute precisely, but you can make good estimates. So for this is in the case of the neutron, this is the current limit, and this rough scale of the standard model contribution is down here. This is for mercury, again, current limit, estimate of the standard model CKM contribution, and similarly for the molecular EDM thorium oxide. Again, standard model contribution, highly suppressed, and so you can argue that if you measure something at current sensitivity, it's not going to be a result of the standard model. Of course, there could be many other sources of background, but it shouldn't be a standard model contribution. One thing, again, to emphasize is that, in fact, all of these don't come from intrinsic EDMs of the quarks or the electron. They seem to come from four Fermi operators. Just because of the way the measurements are done, you are dealing with atomic and nuclear systems, and so it's a question of exactly which term dominates. So something to keep in mind when thinking about this EFT structure. The effects are all proportional to this Yarskog invariant, as you'd expect for CKMCP violation. Okay, so one can go through and make estimates of how these various chains in the EFT lead to experimental sensitivity. I'm not going to talk about it that way. I want to present it graphically. We can come back to the numbers later if people are interested. And I think this is a useful way of thinking about it. So the experimental measurements are all quite different. They're done in different ways. They look at different effective level splittings or changes to precession frequencies of systems. But the actual sensitivity to new physics is not necessarily determined by what those level splittings are in different systems. And this is a consequence of looking for effects that are hidden inside atoms and molecules. This is known as a Schiff screening, although it was known before Schiff really talked about it. This is really an effect of saying that if I measure a neutral system and apply an electric field, it's not going to do anything because it's neutral. So whatever happens inside that neutral system, there has to be screening that will remove the effective field internally. And so to a first approximation, you wouldn't see any effect by looking at a neutral system. Now, those calculations are non-relativistic and rely on point-like assumptions, and if you go past those assumptions, there are sub-leading or, in some cases, important effects that arise from that. So in the case of paramagnetic systems, you actually get a real bonus by looking at heavy systems and taking into account relativistic effects. And so the sensitivity to the applied field is actually dramatically enhanced, and that's one of the reasons for looking at these polar molecules. There's a huge enhancement effect on looking at the sensitivity of the electron, the unpaired electron inside that system. So in fact, these systems gain a lot through Schiff screening because of those enhancement factors. For the neutron, you are looking more or less at quark-gluon interactions. There are no large factors. And for the diamagnetic systems, though, Schiff screening does have an impact, and it has a significant impact for mercury in particular, less so for other systems. And so the sensitivity goes down somewhat. But again, if you're able to measure these tiny shifts, fractions of a nanohertz in the case of mercury, you still get very good sensitivity. Okay, and this is just, again, translating this into either quark EDMs, chromo EDMs, or the electron EDM. So in the case of thorium oxide, and therefore sensitivity to the electron EDM, technically it's not just this interaction. I mentioned this semileptonic operator that's also important here. And the sensitivity is really a linear combination of this and this semileptonic interaction. And the relative coefficients actually turn out to be very similar in many different systems. So it's actually not that easy to unpack the different contributions. The reason for that is that once you take into account Schiff screening, they're almost the same interaction. Of course, the model of physics may determine whether this is important or more important than this, but nonetheless, the sensitivity can be read off by just looking at those interactions in turn. And the calculations here have been studied by a number of groups. They're pretty well under control, sort of 30% level precision, which is good enough at this level. So that was for the paramagnetic systems. For the neutron, this is a hadronic calculation. You have to go from nucleon level to quark level, quark and gluon level. And this is, like any non-perturbative problem in QCD, hard and difficult to control. There has been some recent progress from groups working over a number of years using Lattice QCD to try and improve the precision of these calculations. And I think the nicest result there is a calculation of the quark EDM contribution to DN from the Lattice group, or the group actually in at Los Alamos, including Vincenzo and Lattice collaborators, where the precision there is now actually pretty good. It's still difficult for some of the other operators, but there are a lot of groups working on it. So I won't say more about that. There'll be a number of talks through the week. The one I want to focus on is the last one. So the Mercury EDM nominally is the most impressive limit if you just look at the atomic limit that's obtained experimentally. But of course, it suffers from this shift suppression in terms of sensitivity to new physics. And I wanted to just comment a little bit on the theoretical difficulties there, because I'm going to come back later to sort of think about how these experimental limits have progressed. There's a recent update in the limit on the Mercury EDM just from this year from the group in Washington, which has now pushed it to a level where you could argue, if the theory was good enough, that it might give you the strongest limits on all of the hadronic sources of CP violation. That's not the case, because the theory isn't good enough yet. The precision isn't that high. And so you're sort of limited in the ability to interpret that impressive experimental result. So I wanted to comment on it, because I think that update to the limit is really, you know, sharpening this question of the theoretical control in these systems. Okay, so I'll say a little bit more about how do you calculate the EDM of Mercury. So shift suppression here, I've got it in quotes, what you're really doing is saying that the EDM of the atom is not proportional directly to the EDM of the nucleus. That's what you'd like to access. It's suppressed through the screening. It's suppressed parametrically by a ratio of the nuclear to the atomic radii, which is a large factor. You get a bit back through having a large atom, large atomic number. But it's a suppression, relative suppression, about a factor of 1,000 in the case of Mercury. I should mention that that's not true for all systems. You can look at atomic systems that don't have that large suppression, but it is for Mercury, and that is the place where the best limit has been achieved. So what you have to do is go instead, not look at the EDM, you look at higher order CP violating moments. In the case of Mercury, it's the shift moment. And so there's a relatively well-controlled calculation to determine the dependence of Mercury on the shift moment. And the shift moment is some higher order moment involving charge density and the usual things you define for multipoles. But what you have to do is compute the expectation value of this guy in the ground state. And of course, Mercury is a big system. It's a complicated nuclear problem. The original calculation was done by Victor and his collaborators in the mid-80s, basically doing sort of natural thing you would do to first approximation. You look at the last neutron in this case, put it in the nuclear potential, and look at the effect of the CP violation induced by the shift moment on the system. Or sorry, CP violation induced by, say, pion-nucleon interactions and induced the shift moment. So there's some characteristic scale here that you can get just by looking at nuclear parameters. The charge density and the nuclear potential near the origin is, again, it's nuclear potential, so it's the first approximation, short range, so you can take it to be a delta function. And then you get the shift moment parametrically to be something like the nuclear scale times this CP violating parameter. And you get numbers here that are roughly 0.1 times the usual pion-nucleon coupling G times these CP violating couplings that I wrote down briefly in the EFT expansion before. But this is a first order approximation to the calculation, and the question is, what about sort of collective multi-particle effects in a big system? And there was a lot of work over a number of years to try and improve the precision of that calculation. But again, the parametric scaling is sort of easy to write down. So the question is that what you get, or is it suppressed or enhanced, and so on. And the most recent calculation that was done by John Engel's group produced these results. So here's, again, writing down the shift moment. It's parameterized in a slightly different way. There's two coefficients for the scalar and isovector pion-nucleon couplings, and another term that really corresponds to the intrinsic nucleon contribution, It's been rewritten so that it looks like a contribution to G0, but it's really separate. And remember, the numbers that I had on the previous slide were roughly 0.1 or 0.09. What they did here was a much more sort of sophisticated calculation, density functionals using SKIRM interactions and a range of SKIRM interactions, and you get very different results depending on what interaction you put in. And this has led to some obvious concern about whether we understand this system. Notice that these numbers are all much smaller. So it's a question of, is there a big cancellation going on or not? The characteristic scale doesn't seem to be so obvious there. It was obvious in the earlier calculations. That's to get to the nuclear level. To get to the QCD level, you have to do another QCD calculation. At the moment, the best estimates come through QCD sum rules, but again, not terribly precise. But one could hope maybe that lattice QCD can help here at some point as well. So this is a difficulty. I'm highlighting it here just because the experimental limit is that good, and I think even if the precision can't be improved, if it could be quantified, one could make a lot of progress in terms of understanding what's going on, right? Existing experimental result versus new results. The theory is hard. People have thought about it quite a bit, so it's not easy, but I think it's an area where theory would give immediate results. So another thing, just to emphasize, I suppose, the point is this contribution, which I mentioned is really coming from the intrinsic nucleon EDMs, is sufficiently sensitive that, again, if the theory was under control, it would give you the strongest limit on the neutron EDM, which would be better, actually, than the direct measurement, the current direct measurement. So there's some sort of incentive, I guess, to try and understand this, but it may be hard. So there are other ways that one could go about it. You can use different atoms, and there's been an important progress recently using radium in atomic traps at Argonne Lab. They now have results, have to improve the statistics, but the system seems to be working. And that has far less suppression because of an octopole deformation. So possible improvement there. You can look at other systems where the shift moment is not the dominant contribution. In other lighter nuclei or in molecules, you can look at the magnetic quadrupole moment, which is dominant. Again, you still have the calculational problem of how to determine what the CP violating effects are. And then I think the biggest effort recently is to look at getting ground shift screening completely by going after the nuclear EDM directly. For that, you've now got a charged system. You can't do simple measurements of in cells or in traps. You've got to use a storage ring. And this, at least the technique, was tested long ago in the muon G-2 experiment at Brookhaven, where they did impose a constraint on the EDM of the muon. And so this is really the idea to do it again, but do it specifically for EDMs. And a number of groups are working on that. There'll be several talks. But this is somewhere off in the future. I think my point is that if the theory could be improved, we could get a lot out of existing measurements. But this is clearly a very nice way to proceed. If you could measure multiple light nuclear EDMs, you could actually get direct sensitivity to a number of those parameters. So it's quite systematic. Okay, so in the last 10 minutes or so, I'll switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit about implications for new physics. So the first thing, I guess, to say is things look different depending on when you look at them. So what I decided to do here was, rather than just say what the current sensitivity looks like, I wanted to go back and see what would you have said in some earlier epoch. And I mentioned that, you know, EDMs have been studied for over 60 years, so I could have picked a range of different periods to think about. But because this is a meeting on atomic and nuclear tests, I decided to start in the mid-80s. And there's a very important paper of Victor Fernbaum and his collaborators that really emphasized why you might consider looking at CP violation in nuclear systems and why it could be better in terms of sensitivity than, say, looking at the neutron. So in the mid-80s, this was the experimental status in terms of limits on intrinsic EDMs. The limit on the neutron EDM was already pretty good, few by 10 to the minus 25. The limits on paramagnetic and diamagnetic systems were not as good at that time. And I think partially the reason was thinking that they were not going to be as sensitive as a neutron. But this was a very important paper, and I think it pointed out that if you look at it carefully, they really could be. Now, at that stage, you've also got to take into account what the high energy limits are on new particles. I guess probably the best limits then were from UA1, of course, discovery of W and Z. But limits were characteristically, let's say, 50 to 100 GeV on new physics. And you can translate them very roughly into an EDM by looking at something like scaling that goes as the fermion mass divided by this characteristic sensitivity mass scale, lambda squared, and some loop factors and couplings and so on. So something like 10 to the minus 25 times a TeV over lambda. So if you had sensitivity at 10 to the minus 25, or even 10 to the minus 24, you're already sensitive to interesting phases if your mass limits are around 100 GeV. Okay, let's jump forward now 15 years. So around 2000, this is the era of LEP and Tevatron. And the neutron EDM limit has moved forward a little bit, but the paramagnetic and diamagnetic systems have jumped forward a lot. So this is the limit, the best limit at the time from the Berkeley group, EDM of thallium, so the beam experiment. And this is now again the Washington group with a limit on the EDM of mercury. So in a sense, it was AMO physics that was leading the sort of technological improvement here, although this was a very significant achievement through the collaboration at ILL. So in some sense, it's telling you that this is getting harder. The experiment was a big, very sophisticated experiment, but it's hard to make that improvement. Mass limits had improved. These are the UA1, UA2 limits, and LEP. This is, say, run one of the Tevatron, which is probably the only one that was available at the time. And so you're up to maybe a couple of hundred GeV, maybe 300 GeV. I'm using strongly interacting particles as a benchmark for this sensitivity. It doesn't apply to all new physics particles, but just to get an idea. And because of these improvements, which are significant, these are orders of magnitude, you actually get very good sensitivity to the phases. So I think the first version that we produced of this plot was probably 20 years ago. Well, no, it was 99, I guess, so 18 years ago. And what you can do is just take a supersymmetric model which has two phases and look at the sensitivity implied by the limits on the EDMs in those three categories. This is assuming some generic mass scale around 500 GeV. So these were all very, very impressive limits. Now, since then, things have moved on again. Now let's come to today. So the EDM of the neutron has shifted again, but it's hard. I mean, the technology is difficult. It's shifted a little bit. There's dramatic improvement with the ACME collaboration at Harvard with the new limit from thorium oxide. And similarly, the group at the University of Washington has dramatically pushed forward the limit on the EDM of mercury. So in some ways, what's happened is the atomic and molecular systems have overtaken the neutron. It's not quite true because, as I said, the sensitivity varies, but you can see at least the technological progress that's occurred. Now, the other thing is that the LHC has been operating for the last 5 years, and so the mass limits on new particles have also dramatically improved. We've gone from a couple hundred GeV now to nearly 2 TeV, depending, of course, on what the system might be. And so this progress in EDMs is not translated directly into new sensitivity to phases, because what you have to do is increase the mass limit to get something interesting. Nonetheless, you can still draw a plot like this, and you get interesting sensitivity or non-trivial sensitivity from thorium oxide and also mercury. Those lines look kind of similar, even though the mass has increased because of this increasing sensitivity. For the neutron, less so now from the increase of that limit. I should also mention that the line I've drawn here for mercury is not the thinnest that it could be. Because of the lack of precision in the calculation, it's been broadened, or there's a sort of agreement on what the estimate should be. So there's some sort of induced cancellation that's been put in. It's about a factor of 5 or 6. And so, again, increasing the precision of that calculation would really allow a very non-trivial constraint to come out of that. Okay, so I have a couple of minutes left, I think. So the last thing I wanted to talk about was a different way of probing new physics, and this is again driven by the fact that the LHC hasn't seen anything new yet, and so we don't necessarily know the mass scale of the physics associated with empirical problems. And what are the empirical problems? Well, baryogenesis, in a sense, is one of them, but there are others, right? So neutrino mass, dark matter, these are non-trivial physics problems, but we don't necessarily know what scale is associated with them. Right? Neutrino mass could be Dirac, in which case you add a right-handed neutrino and its mass scale is the same as the left-handed neutrino. It's very light. Or you could have a right-handed neutrino which is up at 10 to the 14 GeV and the mass comes through the seesaw mechanism. They both work perfectly well. Right? So what's sort of intrinsic about those empirical problems? Well, they have to involve new physics which is weakly coupled. Right, so what you can say is, in some sense, whatever the mass scale, they're in a kind of hidden sector. And there's been a lot of work recently in thinking about this sort of framework for new physics, because it does apply quite generally to these problems. So I'm almost out of time, so what I'm going to do is just give you a quick summary, and then since we have 15 minutes for discussions, if you want to hear more, you can come back and ask me. The question really is, what do EDMs imply for this scenario of new physics? And I'll just give you one example. So you could try to be as systematic as possible. You can't be as systematic as you could if new physics was very short distance or had a very short distance origin. But you can do the best you can. And the best we can at the moment is an expansion that looks like this. So I take the standard model and I couple it to this hidden sector, assuming the hidden sector has no standard model charges. And then you say, well, I don't know what the mass scale is, but I should first look at operators that are renormalizable or have dimensions less than or equal to 4, because they wouldn't be suppressed by, well, the coefficients wouldn't be suppressed by some mass scale. And the nice thing about that is there are only 3, or if you like, 4 interactions, but 3 categories. You can introduce a new U1 vector, couple it to hypercharge, a new scalar couple to the Higgs, or this one is just the right-handed neutrino coupling, coupled to LH, which has no standard model quantum numbers. And then ask, what are the new physics effects associated with these types of interactions, even if the hidden sector itself could be quite complicated, it could say it's dark matter candidates and so on. These are the mediators, right, those couplings. And there's been a lot of work in the last few years thinking about this problem. So what I was going to talk about here is just the EDM consequences of this. And I'll give you just one example because it ties in to the one of the other themes for the meeting. So what about neutrino mass? Well, the simplest thing you can do is start adding some right-handed neutrinos. Here's an example where you add 2 singlets, 2 right-handed neutrinos per active flavor, so-called inverse seesaw model. And this allows phases, generically, right? It has phases, you can't remove them unless you set them to 0 by hand. And you can ask, what is the largest EDM that you get? Well, it comes through a diagram like this. It's 2-loop contribution, but it's actually highly suppressed. And so you can ask, not just what is it in the given model, but how big could it possibly be going through this interaction? And the largest we could get was something like 10 to the minus 33. So one characteristic feature of these hidden sector models is that EDMs tend to be small. And that's not true for other precision probes, but it is true for EDMs. So I have another example that I can talk about if people are interested, but I should finish because I'm out of time. So I had really 2 themes for this talk. One of them was just a review of aspects of EDM theory, and in particular, this sort of crystallization of the theoretical problem in the calculation of diamagnetic EDMs. I think if it's possible, maybe not to improve the precision, but to quantify it, we'd gain a lot from the measurement of the EDM of mercury. And the second one I just skimmed over was that, interestingly, if you look at models of new physics that are kind of motivated by neutrino mass and dark matter, they're not necessarily that large, which if you take it positively could mean that's why we haven't seen them yet. Okay, I should finish there. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Adam, for that very nice introduction. Susan, I'm going to...
Okay, let me...
We have the other room. Wander around the room. Possible. Questions for Adam? Collier's got the first one.
Thanks. Which up bound on the neutron and other EDMs would imply that we're not able to explain the baryon abundance in the universe by electronic mechanisms?
Right, so it of course it depends on the model. So electroweak baryogenesis can still work. You have to introduce, well, you have two important things, right? You have to make sure there's a strong enough first order phase transition for the bubble to have a sizable wall and latent heat and so on. So that requires usually new scalar degrees of freedom. The EDMs can come from various sources, so it doesn't really matter too much what you put in, but those two ingredients have to go through. And the limits from the neutron and in principle from mercury as well can be significant. And the electron may be significant depending on what the model is. So in supersymmetric models, they're all important. In other models, you may have one or two and not all three. I can't give a, I don't think anyone can give a blanket answer as to exactly what limit do you need to get to rule it out. You can do that within classes of models, and it's certainly under a lot of strain at the moment for minimal supersymmetry. In fact, it may already be too late for minimal supersymmetry, but it's still possible with extensions.
More questions?
The hidden portal discussion on limit on the upper limit on the EDM, it's surprising that you have such a tight limit with a model that's not terribly well constrained. What is it the experimental constraints on the hidden sectors that make it so tight?
Yeah, it's a good question. So thanks for the opportunity to say a little bit more. So in this case, it doesn't look like it should be that bad, actually. It's just a two-loop diagram. Why is it so small? One way to understand where this comes from is that to have a source of neutrino mass, or in this case, it's a Majorana mass, so you have some violation of lepton number. EDMs by themselves don't violate lepton number, so it actually has to be proportional to lepton number squared. And that ends up really giving you proportionality to the light neutrino mass scale. So that's really why this diagram ends up being quite suppressed. So the empirical information is, yes, what the light neutrino masses are. And that's true actually in other cases as well. We could build models that are more significant, give much larger EDMs if it weren't for other empirical information. So it's really the fact that it's quite a tightly constrained mediation framework, and there are limits on what those couplings can be.
Can you put up slide 34 while we take the next question?
Sure. Yeah, I didn't get to talk about this one. Thanks. Oh, it wasn't your question. It was just the slide.
Why take the next question?
Oh, what?
It's not a question. It's a little comment. Because you mentioned about decoupling of electron EDM and contribution of electron nucleon CP-violet interaction. Actually, the ratio is calculated very well. It's nearly analytical. So when you compare, it's good.
Yeah, it's just that the numbers are all very similar, right?
Yeah. And also, if necessary, atomic and molecular calculations may be improved.
Yeah.
It's not a major problem. It's not nuclear calculation. They're much more under control. It's actually accuracy maybe 10%. For thallium, it's few percent, for example, not 30%.
Yeah.
For mercury, atomic, 10%. For molecular, it's also approaching 10%. But the ratio, again, ratio, when you need to decouple it, it's calculated better. It's nearly analytical.
Yeah. No, absolutely. That's a good point. So I was just mentioning that those two contributions somehow enter in a very similar way, but it's not that's a problem.
Yeah, but they enter in a similar way. This is another side of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, so what Victor is saying is that this coefficient here, which is the way of translating the sensitivity to electron EDM, is calculable with high precision, which is certainly true. Yeah.
May I ask a question? Yeah, so I wanted to ask you about the collective multiparticle effects in regards to the computation of the shift moments at mercury 199, because you mentioned it as a uncertainty, but assessed no even a simple numerical scale associated with it. And I dare say in the updated Banatol calculation, they are not addressed either. And I was wondering if you had anything more to say about it.
Especially the other people here. John here? Not, I don't know. I thought he was, is he on the list for the meeting? John Engel? Okay, I'm not sure. Anyway, if he's not here now, the characteristic scale is this one, which comes from Victor's paper. So the real question is, why is it suppressed? Right. So this is sort of a characteristic nuclear scale based on the charge density and the nuclear potential. So that number is this coefficient here, right? It's about 0.1. And
no, it's really the blue line, the last on the previous slide. This later calculation select collective multiparticle effects.
Yeah, 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 okay.
So what precisely do you mean by that?
Oh, this is mainly, well, it's assumed to be mainly core polarization.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that's presumably what's making these numbers jump around. Sorry, yeah, I misunderstood. But that's a question for experts in nuclear theory, and I'm not one of them. This is really this comes from a series of papers. It's not just John's paper, but these improvements actually did include core polarization. So, for example, these numbers are not so dissimilar from the sort of naive estimate, but this one you see is dramatically suppressed. And the question is that real, or is it? It's just a calculational issue. But it's the dominant effect, at least for these papers, was core polarization.
But I think all these calculations are still really schematic on the standard scale of nuclear physics. And you put your finger on the problem. I mean, in principle, we've thought about this for the new symmetries topical collaboration. You can now do a microscopic calculation of the mercury EDM. Mm-hmm. It's about a factor of 3 beyond sort of state of the art. But
yeah.
You know, with computers, we can do that. The problem is, if you do such a calculation, what's the impact? And once you have 3 or 4 other numbers in the literature, since all of these calculations are model dependent, the error bar winds up having to include all of them because we have no other way of establishing what a true error bar is. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to know, even if you did an absolutely state-of-the-art calculation, it's hard to know whether it's really going to have any impact or not.
Mm-hmm. No, that's what the error bar is the issue, right? Because that's not, what this calculation, I guess, was state-of-the-art in 2010.
So they're all models, and so they don't have error bars in that sense.
So if you look at the numbers, it seems that the contribution from the constituent nucleon EDM is not necessarily much smaller than the pion exchange contribution. But is there a contribution from the intrinsic shift moment of the nucleons?
Sorry, which one were you talking about?
For mercury, for instance.
For mercury? The shift moment of...
Yeah, so if you calculate the electric dipole form factor of the nucleon, you also get the shift moment out.
Oh, you mean the form factor?
Yeah, the form.
Sorry,
so
thanks.
Yes.
So one question has been, if you go to a heavy nucleus, whether the EDMs of the intrinsic nucleons are enough, or because you've got Fermi energy, whether you should actually be including some momentum dependence and the full form factor. That's a good question. It's probably one you should comment on. I don't know. I mean, that's a good question, I think, for heavy nuclei. If you've got energy scales of around, 40 MeV, whether you need some information about what the form factor is doing at that scale. I think, again, maybe it's a general problem, right? What's the full set of important parameters that enter into the calculation, and how do you estimate precision for all of those?
Any other questions for Adam?
Maybe not a very important question, but I know there's no reason to worry that CS and EDM cancel out, but I kind of get paid to worry about things that I don't have to worry about. That's how EDM experiments actually get moved forward. Should I just forget about that?
I guess Victor was saying that there's no problem with the calculation of those two contributions. I think at some level it doesn't matter, because you could write the limit as the sum of those two, so a limit on the sum,
sure,
with a given well-known coefficient, which is a relative factor. The reality is, until we know what new physics is producing the CP violation, you don't know whether there's some cancellation or not. And
you might want to assign as a probability that would occur. That is so different, the probability is negligible.
It's very much dependent. I mean, there's no reason to believe that, you know, a single source of CP violation would only produce one and not the other. In most cases, one will be dominant, but you could cook up something.
I'm talking about the cancel.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. In most models of CP violation, so the electron EDM will be much larger than CS or vice versa. Yeah, But what I was going to say is that the difficulty at the moment is if you take your limit and then you take the next limit in terms of sensitivity and try and disentangle the two pieces to get an intrinsic limit on, say, DE, that reduces the sensitivity a lot because they're always aligned. So it's aligned for thorium oxide, it's aligned for terbium fluoride and thallium and so on. But, you know, intrinsically, it's a limit on the sum of the two, and there's no particular reason to assume they would cancel. But I can't kind of give you the firm result because it depends on the model.
Okay, I'm going to use the chair's prerogative here to ask the last question.
Oh, sure.
Could you get back to the current limits you said from the zero?
Right at the beginning?
Their current limits compared to theory, right at the end, actually, towards the end.
Oh, sorry. This one?
Yeah, keep going. There we go. Okay. I mean, you can give the current numbers for each of those three types of categories. And I'm just asking for, this is really an experimental question in some sense. How far do you think any of these things can be pushed? Now, Brad here is going to tell us he can push it optimistically, maybe two orders of magnitude. It can be almost, I would think, impossible to go much further. The Harvard-Yale experiment had this very nice new molecular result that made a big push, and I think they can probably get another factor of 10. At least they think they can.
I'll give a talk about that.
Yeah. So.
At least, I think.
Okay, even 100, but it's going to require a major new idea to go much further. I mean, how far do you think we can go on these? That's my closing question.
You really shouldn't ask me that question. I mean, maybe just to go back to, maybe I'll go back to that slide. Yeah. I mean, this is the available sort of parameter space if, you know, there were no experimental issues. But it's really an experimental question. And so there's, you know.
Where do you think you can get to?
I'll just go back to the other slide I showed.
Three, okay.
You know, that's the progress in 30 years.
Right.
That's pretty good.
You think you'd be at three, you're gonna tell us how far do you think you can push that?
I'd rather answer it kind of more generally that right now with the thorium oxide experiment, we're using molecular beam methods. Now, it's true we're using a brand new kind of molecular source, which gives us about a factor of 1,000 higher intensity than previous ones for these radicals like THO. But nonetheless, it's still a molecular beam experiment. We haven't applied any of the modern ultra-cold techniques that, you know, have given us 10 to the minus 19 precision clocks, have given us quantum entanglement control measurements. So I'd rather just say that and then leave it to one's imagination about how far one could eventually go. With just a molecular beam method, come to my talk.
And then the diamagnetic, let's see, Blaine Hempel's supposed to be here at some point, but I don't see him. I mean, they pushed that.
They pushed that a long way, yeah.
It's hard to imagine they could go much further, at least with the mercury.
Well, again, I'll chime in. Again, that has not used what we would call the most modern methods of control and clock science.
Okay, well, let's thank Adam for a great